Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the rest of my time on this show. It's politics out the boring bits, Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. Coming up on today's episode, as David Cameron, well, nestles into the Foreign Office and starts planning his first trips around the world, we ask, how's he going to go down in the capital cities of the world? We fire up Times Radio Airways and do a quick whistle-stop tour of the world. We're in Israel and Washington and Brussels and Berlin. Really fascinating chat there. And then, because everyone's still banging on about Brexit, there's a brand new theatre show where Alex Salmond and David Davies argue about Brexit. I actually want to ask them, what's it like when seeing the bloke who's beaten you, whether it's in a Tory leadership contest or a Scottish referendum, he's back in politics. What do they make of David Cameron's comeback? That's coming up in just a moment. But it's a Tuesday, so it's a how to win an election day. The full episode is available over wherever you're listening to this right now. But here is a little taster of this week's episode of How to Win an Election, all about how Peter Mandelson was brought back by a former chancellor, became prime minister, got into a spot of bother and reached out to a rival to try and shore him up. So, strike up the band!
You're proposing throughout the entire series to repeat the fact that I kept losing elections.
I think I've lost elections worse and harder than you.
Nobody is better at losing the elections than the Labour Party.
Here we are again. Then no reshuffle here on how to win an election. Everyone's still in their place. We've still got new Labour mastermind Peter Mandelson. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Matt.
Polly McKenzie, who is Director of Policy for Nick Clegg in the Coalition. Hello, Polly.
Hello, Matt.
And Tory Brainbox, Danny Finkelstein, is here as well. Are you enjoying us adding in constant different ways of you saying that you're losing Danny into the intro? Now, although, Polly, you were boasting that you had a record of losing elections, but a source has been in touch with us with details of when you first won an election. I now have the full details of the first election Polly won through underhand means. The first year form captain elections at a school in Monmouth. She was up against my wife, who for the purpose of the election is the noble but thwarted Al Gore, winner of the popular vote but loser on a technicality. They both want to be form captain. Me being English said to Polly, no, don't vote for me, I don't care. I voted for Polly. Polly being an election winning machine took my vote and then voted for herself. That was what tipped it. Do you remember any of that?
I remember none of that.
And that's how...
Is that convenient? That's how political memory works.
Yeah, so thank you to our secret source, Tom Whipple, Science Editor of the Times. Apparently his wife ran against you at
school. His ex at Times as well, in fact, yeah.
I thought you were going to say ex-wife.
I was going to say ex-wife. No, well,
another
ex-friend. I missed that.
I can't believe... I shall have words with Catherine.
Well, if you want to get in touch with any other Times that Polly's done you over, you can email howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. Or if you've got questions or comments or queries or complaints about the podcast, you can email howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. So let's turn to how to win at a reshuffle. So you've got a former chancellor who became prime minister, struggling in the face of grim economic headwinds, turns to a former political foe, sticks him in the House of Lords, and prays it will help turn the polls around ahead of a looming election. Sound familiar?
Of course we must face facts, electorally,
We are in the fight of our lives. And yes, we do start that fight as underdogs. But conference, let me say this. If I can come back, we can come back.
So that was you, Peter. On your comeback, that was at the 2009 Labour Party conference. You returned to the cabinet a year earlier as a peer to help Gordon Brown try and turn things around. It's probably fair to say your relationship with Gordon Brown up until that point was probably more fraught than even that between Remainer David Cameron and Brexiteer Rishi Sunak. So take us back to 2008. You're minding your own business. Gordon Brown, what, picks up the phone, comes round with a box of chocolates? How does it work?
I'm minding my own business, very, very happily being European Trade Commissioner, existing in the rest of the world, not barely thinking about Britain. But every now and again, I would get an invitation from somebody who knew Gordon, who was close to Gordon. This was in the months beforehand. And they'd say, why don't you come round for dinner and just chat about, you know, how things are going in Britain, which were pretty grim. Gordon faced a terrible and torrid first year as Prime Minister when everything went wrong and he slipped further and further down in the opinion polls. And so I'd give my advice and my two halfpenny worth and go back on the next train to China, Japan or somewhere in Africa or whatever. And then things became a little bit more intense. And I remember Gordon phoning me. I was in Singapore. He phoned me literally in the middle of the night. And said, I've got to make a statement tomorrow about I cannot remember what. How do you think I should, you know, deal with it? And I thought, God, you know, here I am, fast asleep in Singapore, couldn't be further from the scene of action in London. And he was basically trying to sort of reach out and to befriend me and make things up and sort of, you know, and I would say, look, you know, if I can help you, I will. But the last thing I thought was that I'd be helping him by actually returning to his government. And then on the fateful week, I was due to return to London to be briefed by the Treasury on the financial crisis and the crisis in our banks because they needed to smooth things over with the Commission and make sure the Commission was happy with their recapitalisation of the banks, which was going to take place that weekend. And it was a Thursday, and I went into the Treasury. I was duly briefed, and then I was asked whether I could just nip into Number 10 to see the Prime Minister. So, of course, I went in. I sat down in the small wood-panelled state dining room at Number 10, and there in front of me was a pot of yoghurt, a slightly browning banana, and a sort of slightly curling sandwich. And that was lunch. And Gordon came in and said, thank you very much, you know, for coming in to see me. I'm sorry, you know, it's a short notice, but I wonder whether I could sort of make you an offer. I said, well, like this lunch. And he said, no, I want you to rejoin the government. We're facing a terrible crisis. It's not been a brilliant time. We're going to completely refocus and reset the entire government, and I want you to be the centrepiece of it. Will you do so? And I said, I'm not sure about that. I'll think about it. And he looked at me in a slightly quizzical way and said, when you say think about it, you mean like 10 minutes? And I said, no.
Have to eat a yogurt.
I'll come back. You know, I'll let me think about it over the weekend. He said, no. He said, this is going to be announced tomorrow. And I said, no, Gordon, you don't understand. You know, I've got a job, a trade commissioner. I've got to, you know, I can't just sort of up and sticks and leave Brussels and rejoin your government. He said, you've got to. And I said, well, do you mind if I call a friend and get some advice? I went out and I went round to see Tony Blair. And by the time I got to Blair's office in Grosvenor Square, Gordon had phoned him. And Tony received me with a very, very broad Tony-ish grin and said, you couldn't make it up. And I said, well, what am I going to do? And he said, Gordon's rung me. He's asked me to make sure that you say yes. And you've got no alternative. If in a state of national crisis, the Prime Minister asks you to do something to help the country, you've got to do it. So you've got to do it. And that was it. My fate was sealed.
Just remind listeners
about how bad your relationship had got with Gordon Brown.
Do I have to?
Clearly you were... Well, I could
it
ask
was the, pretty dire.
I could ask the question. But you were just there at the beginning, the formation of New Labour with Gordon and Tony, but then over time... So we were the three musketeers.
Yeah. And from the late 80s onwards, we were the three modernisers of the Labour Party, and it started basically after the 1987 election. They were up-and-coming members of the Shadow Cabinet. I was the party's communications and campaigns director. And we formed a really strong cadre, and we couldn't have been closer. I mean, everything we did was sort of hand in glove, and we consulted each other on everything, every speech, utterance, statement, political move. And all was going swimmingly until, tragically, John Smith died in 1994, and then we had to make the fateful choice between the two modernisers, Brown or Blair. And Brown blamed me eternally thereafter for the choice of Blair. It was not my choice. All I did was to say, look, let's sort of, you know, stand back and decide which of you has the better chance, you know, where your support lines up, etc. And overnight, the entire sort of party, trade unions, Labour MPs, even in Scotland, moved like a block to Tony. And I was the one who had to go to Gordon 2 days later and say, look, you know, you just got to look at what's happening amongst the MPs, look at the opinion polls, the trade unions lining up. I'm very sorry, you're going to have to, if you want to beat Tony, if you want to stop Tony running, you are going to have to summon the most enormous dark forces, and you are going to have to go in and just could have kill him. Do you really want to do that? If you do that, the modernizers will be dead. You know, we'll just be set at each other's throats. Mm. It will be the end of the whole project. You've got to decide one or the other. And I got to tell you, in all candor and friendship, the party is lining up behind Tony and not you. And therefore, we've got to decide how you're going to airlift yourself out of this. And I'll give you every support and help in doing that so that you come out of it sort of strongly with your dignity intact and everything. And from that moment on, Tony, of course, won the leadership, and Gordon barely spoke to me again because he just thought that I had but been behind this manoeuvre.
For 10 years.
He sort of... I mean, we had the odd conversation now and again. But basically, he and his gang did for me. In the most sort of ghastly way. And so that made it all the more sort of ironic and dramatic when I was summoned in, you know, to the yogurt and the banana in the small state dining room to be asked to come back and save his government, which I did as a very loyal deputy. I mean, some people said to me afterwards, you know, your job is to make sure that Gordon doesn't last, that he's replaced with a genuine New Labour moderniser. They wanted David Miliband, and there was one sort of attempted sort of skirmish or coup after another, and I wasn't having any of it. I hadn't come back to bury Gordon Brown. I'd come back to save Gordon Brown. I'd already, inverted commas, buried him once. I wasn't going to do it again. And therefore, I stood behind him all the way through. And even to today, some people blame me for the loss of the 2010 election because I didn't move quickly and sharply enough to replace Gordon with David Miliband. But of course, the person who didn't move, the person who sort of quivered and wouldn't make his move against Gordon was, of course, David Miliband. And I wasn't going to do it on his behalf.
It's an amazing story, yeah. But the parallels, Danny, with what's happened this week with David Cameron coming back, given that basically David Cameron and Rishi Sunak fell out when Rishi Sunak backed Brexit, and he was told, if you do that, your career will be over because Remain are going to win. They were squabbling only 6 weeks ago with the fate of HS2.
It's true.
And now here they are. I mean, it's clearly not as bad as
I think
10 years more of no yoghurt.
They don't really basically have much of a relationship at all, though. Mm. I think Rishi Sunak has a better relationship with George Osborne, probably, than with David Cameron. I don't really think they've been that close. They've had the sort of, you know, Peter will know, is when I was working with William Hague, for example, you were constantly thinking, what will John Major think of this change that we're making? And you'd ring them up. And that's the sort of relationship you have with a former leader. And I don't think Rishi Sunak's relationship with David Cameron went much beyond that. He wasn't in Parliament for long before David fell. His relationship has always been very strong with William Hague. And, there have been suggestions that William was, a bit of a go-between between the two of them. But I mean, you can always phone up. You can always phone up David Cameron. You'd have that relationship with him. It wasn't the same. This, the relationship that, that Peter had with Gordon Brown was had been so intensely close, and then it split. I think that's different, isn't it?
It started in the mid-1980s, so it was a very intense relationship.
It wasn't two people who were part of the same project.
Did David Cameron speak to you about it before?
No, he didn't. And I think that that it was kept secret, and I think that he must have only told one or two people. If I had to guess, I would say he'll definitely have spoken to George Osborne about it, and he'll have spoken to Andrew Feldman about it, Lord Feldman, who was the chairman of the Conservative Party, and he's his closest ally and friends at university. They talk about everything, and I think, and obviously he'll have consulted Samantha, but that he wouldn't have gone beyond that. If the moment either of them went beyond that, if Rishi went much beyond James Forsyth and Liam Booth-Smith, it would have leaked.
The problem, Danny, is that Sunak would have been worried about Cameron turning him down. I mean, so he certainly didn't want it leaked. He didn't want it sort of pumped into the media ether and a discussion started in case Cameron didn't then come back. Yeah. And that would have been portrayed as a huge setback. So it had to be done in complete secrecy.
I bet he got William to ask him that question first. They wouldn't have had a meeting in person until knew that he would. Because William, for example, himself, I know, and anybody who's spoken to William would know, would if he'd been offered it, 100% have turned it down. So you wouldn't have asked him in the first place. I bet you anything that a feeler was put out to David before.
Polly, take us to the moment when you saw David Cameron walking up Downing Street. What went through your mind?
Actually, a bit of a sense of relief and positivity. And it actually did take me back to, I remember being just a sort of lowly opposition advisor when Peter returned to government. And there was a sense of calm. Because politics is so dominated by these rivalries and resentments and the who said what to whom 20 years ago. And it's so toxic so often. And if you think about what's happened to the Conservative Party, where we've had this rapid succession of prime ministers, each of which has very clearly tried to define themselves against the previous one, and their big radical policies have been unpicking policies that they backed just a few months or years ago, The idea of actually making, I guess, a big, open and generous offer, which is the language Cameron used when he offered the coalition agreement to the Liberal Democrats, of just saying, let's find forgiveness. Let's be in the same team. It's only the beginning. But actually, to have a team instead of a set of rivalries and resentments that have all gone toxic and mouldy is the only way to actually move forward.
I think this is a very good point Polly's making. Look, when I came back, and this is why it's not quite the same as David Cameron's return, I was brought back in order to make the entire government function differently and better. I was brought back in order to enable it to help it to communicate better to the outside world, but also to smooth over and heal some of the differences and ill feeling that had grown up in Gordon's cabinet. But it was all part of a major reset, a strategic reset of the whole government. The whole point of my coming back and joining the economic war cabinet was part of the government's entire refocusing on fighting the global financial crisis. I am not so persuaded that David Cameron's return is the beginning of a major strategic reset of Rishi Sunak's government. I think for that to happen, Rishi Sunak would really have to decide what sort of Tory leader he wants to be, what sort of Tory government he wants to lead. Is it a sort of centre-facing, moderate, unifying, one-nation conservative government, or is it one which tilts more to the right and is fending off the draining of support from the Conservatives to the further right Reform Party? And I think that what Sunak wants to be is the right-leaning Conservative leader with a bit more centrist vibe. And that's what he's getting from David Cameron. I think it's a piece of wonderful sort of window dressing and very elaborate theatre. I mean, not quite as dramatic. I mean, after all, David Cameron is only returning to the government for the first time. I mean, he's not the three times comeback kid that I was. And, you know, so he's a sort of...
Thankfully.
He's a young pretender. He's got some way to go. He was also walking down... Downing Street yesterday, minus that wonderful crimson red jumper that sparked so much speculation in the media. You know, but what was it made of? Where was it bought?
This was your jumper.
This was my jumper when I walked up Downing Street. And in the end, the press office settled on, well, it's a cashmere mix, you know, sort of very New Labour. And that's satisfying.
You're wearing a very nice jumper today. Was that sort of
thing? It's a sort of rust brown.
The thing about walking up Downing Street, and there's always these photographers outside. And I said to one of them once, because they kind of ran around trying to photograph me after I'd left number 10. And I said, you're just keeping that in case I get into a scandal. But there's no way that you're going to run this under any other circumstances. It's only if I'm in a scandal, your editor will go, oh, has anyone got... Oh,
well, we're still waiting, Danny.
Yeah, we're still waiting. Danny Finkelstein's scandal.
But I agree with Peter. So I think that choosing to remove Suella Braverman and put David Cameron in the cabinet is an extremely big choice. The question is now, will he see it through? If he doesn't see it through, then it is pretty pointless to do it.
And to hear the rest of this week's episode of How to Win an Election, just search How to Win an Election wherever you're listening to this. Right, up next, we are boarding the aeroplane to tour the globe to find out, does anybody want to meet David Cameron?
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
Yeah, David Cameron packing his bags and setting off around the world, replacing James Cleverly as Foreign Secretary. But how will he go down? Will they be rolling out the red carpet for him, the former Prime Minister, arriving in cities around the world? Will he come with too much diplomatic baggage? Well, we thought we'd fire up Times Radio Airways once more. We'll find out which country and conflict will be at the top of David Cameron's in-tray. So all aboard. Your seats in an upright position, please, as we head, first of all, to Israel, where Anshul Pfeffer is there for us. Hi, Anshul.
Good afternoon, mate.
I mean, clearly, the conflict between Israel and Hamas is the most pressing foreign policy issue for the government, and therefore David Cameron as the foreign secretary. What's his reputation like there as a sort of honest broker? Does him being a former prime minister give him extra purchase, or does his past record, including saying in 2010... Gaza cannot and must not be allowed to remain a prison camp. Does his record actually count against him? How will he go down?
To be honest, he never really made much of an impression here. He was, you know, he made the customary visits as leader opposition. He made, you know, he was here as prime minister, but there wasn't any real like diplomatic missions or peace building efforts on his behalf in any of his political career. And you know, you mentioned the stuff that he said. I think he said that while he was still leader of the opposition, and maybe it was still his hoodie phase, I don't know. But as prime minister, he was certainly on policy matters probably the most pro-Israel prime minister that Britain had, at least until that point, even going beyond Blair and Brown, who have also seen as very pro-Israel. Cameron changed the law on universal jurisdiction, which was something that bothered the Israelis a lot. He pushed behind the scenes new sanctions on Iran while he was prime minister. So he was seen in the 7 years as a PM as being very pro-Israel, but at the same time, not massively involved in Middle East policy. And I don't think that was ever been one of his main foreign policy interests.
So does it make a difference that he was part, his premiership overlapped with Benjamin Netanyahu? I mean, the people have been speculating that actually he might get into meetings with world leaders rather than his sort of direct counterparts. Or is it this bluntly actually a conflict which will only really be resolved with the intervention of the US and Britain, regardless of who the foreign secretary is a sort of side player in this?
Well, I think Cameron would probably get a meeting with Netanyahu if he were to come. And I've already heard rumours that they're starting to look at the schedule for a visit in the next few days. He does have more stature. And as you said, he's met Netanyahu a number of times because their terms as prime minister have coincided. But you're right. At the end of the day, the only country which really matters here outside the region is the United States. And Britain is, even amongst European countries, is not seen as the most influential. Britain is probably at the lowest point in centuries, I think, of its influence in the Middle East.
Thanks so much for that. That's Angel Pfeffer there in Israel for The Times. So if America is more important, let's head there now. It's all back on the plane. Stow away your tables. Sit bags at the ready. We are crossing the Atlantic. We're heading to America to hear from Katlin Dornbos, who covers Washington, D.C. for The New York Post. And I asked her if Washington was gripped by the news that David Cameron is back.
I would say no. Unfortunately, the U.S. doesn't particularly keep up to date with the Secretary of State's. However, I would venture to say that Washington itself, at least the Biden administration, might be leaning more towards being receptive to him being in place just because some of their policy issues align.
I suppose that's the more important thing, isn't it? It doesn't matter if everyone in America is gripped by Rishi Sunak's reshuffle. It's the message that Britain can land in Washington at a time when, you know, America's connections with the rest of the world are constantly in flux. Does David Cameron have a decent reputation in Washington? He was obviously very close to Barack Obama, met him even actually before he became prime minister, but yes, then called the referendum, got Barack Obama to stick his neck out and say, you'll be at the back of the queue and all of that during the campaign, and then lost the thing and had to resign. So I just wonder how he's sort of viewed in Washington.
Yeah, I think he's very viewed, not just in Washington, but all across the country, positively. I think the United States looked at the Brexit option and the referendum as, you know, they were in support of this movement of democracy, letting the people vote. But ultimately, I think David Cameron took on a lot of respect when he stepped down from the position and wasn't in support of Brexit to begin with.
What about if, hypothetically, there's a lot of ifs here, if Rishi Sunak wins an election at some point next year, which they'll most likely have to be, and if Donald Trump returns as president, any sense of the relationship between Donald Trump and the Trump camp and David Cameron, given that David Cameron was so pro-Remain and Trump was an enthusiastic Brexiteer and mates with Nigel Farage?
I think Trump would have gotten on phenomenally with Suella Braverman. With her gone, having a new administration with David Cameron in there would maybe be a little bit fraught with Donald Trump. I mean, we'll see. Donald Trump is very into America First and insular, but I think I just don't know if David Cameron would even want to have much of a relationship himself.
Just finally, then, we've actually seen Rishi Sunak and Joe Biden have had quite a lot of meetings and contact and phone calls and all that sort of thing. Just in terms of what is in David Cameron's in-tray, what should he be thinking about doing? What might Joe Biden want from this new-look British government?
He's going to want to work with the UK on international issues, especially Ukraine, especially China, especially Israel. There are so many conflicts going on right now that I think that he is just trying to catch his breath and get as much international support as he can, because ultimately the United States can throw money at any problem, but it's alliances that really are its strength. And the UK is one of the most important alliances that we have.
Do you think just being David Cameron will open doors in Washington that an unknown foreign secretary wouldn't?
I would assume so. I mean, this is a name that Americans actually recognize. I mean, I think if you asked who the prime minister was, I'm not sure many Americans could tell you the current Rishi, but they certainly know David Cameron. And I think that's because of his work with Obama during that administration, but also because of his role in the Brexit vote.
Katelyn Dalbosc, who covers Washington, D.C. for the New York Post. But we're back on the plane now. Not taking a very direct route this, but now going back across the Atlantic, heading to Europe. Let's go to Germany. Christina Jovanovsky is a journalist based in Berlin. Christina, David Cameron bowls up in Berlin. Will he get a good reception, or do they still remember the Brexit days?
I think it'll overall be good news for the German government. Certainly people here remember him as introducing the Brexit referendum. When I talked to a German yesterday and I told her about the decision, she said it was ironic. You could see a lot of surprise from the German press here of the decision. At the same time, Cameron was someone who was in support of remaining in the EU. So I don't think he'll be seen as necessarily a bad person, but as someone who made, in terms of the German perspective, a foolish decision. So I don't think there's animosity, but I think there was bewilderment over this decision as well as holding the referendum. But I think overall it'll be a good step for the German government in its relations with the UK, because Cameron will be a bit closer to the ideology of the German government, the politicians, especially the foreign ministry, which is led by the Green Party.
It's interesting because there was definitely a sense that when he was prime minister that he sort of misinterpreted his cordial relationship with Angela Merkel, thought he was going to get lots of concessions on immigration as part of his renegotiation. He didn't get it. And then he sort of reassured her and others that, don't worry, I'm going to win this referendum. It didn't pan out like that. Do you think he'll be more cautious when dealing with Olaf Scholz? I mean, clearly he won't have that same relationship as some of the other world leaders that we're looking at today.
Well, Mr. Scholz did actually meet with Cameron right before the referendum, a few months before the referendum. Scholz was the mayor of Hamburg at the time, although he did have a lot of experience in national politics in the parliament as well before that. Cameron had gone to a dinner in Hamburg along with the Chancellor Merkel, the leader of Germany at the time, and had met with Scholz during that time. So Scholz has a bit of experience with Cameron. I think Scholz will really respect that there is a foreign secretary that has experience, political experience, and that their ideologies and their rhetoric won't be so far away as the previous foreign secretary.
Christina, thanks a lot for that. Christina Jovanovsky, based in Berlin. Well, we're talking a lot about Brexit. Let's get back on the plane and we'll speak to Bruno Waterfield, who reports from Brussels for The Times. Hi, Bruno.
Hello.
I bet you've probably seen the back of him the number of times, late night summits you've covered in Brussels and David Cameron. Now he's bowled up again. How will he go down with politicians in Brussels and in other European capitals, do you think?
He's not held in high regard. He really isn't held in high regard. I was in a bar in Brussels when he resigned, when he was at the podium outside Downing Street. I'm sure you'll remember, Matt, he walked back into Downing Street, sort of humming and warbling to himself. And I was with a diplomat from a country, very a real Anglophile as well. And he was really, really shocked. And there was this real shock that instead of he'd gambled on this vote, which he'd been advised against by all other European leaders, he'd rushed through a renegotiation. They said to leave it until 2017. He wanted to rush it through, and then, you know, when it goes wrong, he was arrogant during the campaign. European leaders were saying, oh, it's not going too well, is it, David? And he'd go, don't worry, I'm a winner. Look at me, I'm a winner. And so complacency, arrogance, all the rest of it. And then it goes terribly wrong. It all blows up. He resigns walks off warbling into Downing Street, turns up a day later in Brussels for a summit, behaved according to, you know, most people in the room like a petulant child. He had a go at Angela Merkel and said it was all her fault. And he enraged people so much that at that summit, his last summit on June the 28th, they agreed a declaration which then blew up the Brexit negotiations. It made it very difficult for the European negotiators and also for British negotiators to start from a clean slate, because David Cameron, in a fit of moodiness as he departed, kind of poisoned the atmosphere. So he is held in low regard, especially actually in France. And it's actually Sunak, Boris Johnson as well, actually, with Ukraine, that have rebuilt the links and the relationships with Europe. So certainly in most European capitals, certainly in Brussels, certainly in Paris, Cameron, you know, comes with a lot of baggage, and is not, you know, he's not seen as the saviour of a Conservative government. And in fact, the only positive people see is it's no longer necessary for a British Conservative Prime Minister to appoint a Brexiteer to oversee relations with the EU. And I think that is seen as a minor positive. But I think this is very much seen as the last gasp of a British Prime Minister, Sunak, who's on his way out.
Wow. Thank you for that, Bruno. Bruno Waterfield there. The number of late nights I've had with Bruno in Brussels in summits where David Cameron's been about to get that deal. It's no wonder he probably isn't going to go down all that well. Right. After all that excitement, it's back on the play. We need to head back to London. It turns out then that Brexit is going to still hang quite heavy, particularly in some of those European capitals. Well, would you like to hear two people that are still arguing about Brexit? Of course you would. Not only are they here, you can go and see them in a theatre show as well. Joining me in the studio, former Brexit Secretary David Davis. David, good to see you.
And you.
And former Scottish First Minister Alex Salmond, now leader of the Our Party. Alex, good to see you.
Great to be here, Matt.
So, we'll come in a moment to this live show that you're doing where you're going to battle it out. But you've both crossed swords with David Cameron over the years. David, you ran against him for the Tory leadership.
Yeah.
And we all know how that panned out.
Yeah.
Alex, you ran against him with the referendum in 2014.
That's right. I mean, you know, I got on reasonably well with him and set up the referendum. I mean, I did object on trying to enlist the late Queen onto the no side. Of course, he was panicking in the last couple of weeks, as we know from his autobiography.
But it worked.
Well, did his panic work? I don't know. I mean, I think it was a grand short-term move by Rishi Sunak to appoint Cameron, took everybody by surprise. But I think I would have appointed David Davis. I mean, more brains, less baggage.
David, were you surprised not to get the call?
No.
What went through your minds yesterday when you saw David Cameron walking up Downing Street?
Well, I mean, David's a clever man. He'll be a competent foreign secretary. I mean, he won't be a Carrington or a Hurd because they have much more depth than them. But you know, he'll probably be better than some of the ones that's gone before. So from that point of view, I can understand it. But I also thought, well, you know, he's got some things to weave through. You know, like obviously the Greensill stuff, which will come back and haunt him, I'm afraid, but also some of the relationships with China and so on. So I'm not quite sure how he'll do that. But I guess the starkest thing is not really to do with him, except the fact that he's in the Lords, you know. And we're at a time in the history of our country when it's been more global challenges than I've seen since 1979. And so the Commons will have a lot of views on that. You know, I mean, Israel alone is going to, and it's going to be quite difficult to. I mean, you know, Andrew Mitchell will do a stand-in job, but it's not him making a decision. So there's an issue to deal with there. I'm not quite sure how they're going to square that circle.
Does it make you more confident about the Tories' election prospects? Did Rishi Sunak 6 weeks ago was doing the "I'm the change guy"? Everything that's gone before me is terrible. Now he's taken the architect of everything that's gone before and stuck him in the cabinet. Well, is that a better plan?
That's what asked me in 4 weeks' time, really. I don't know yet, is the honest answer. I mean, I'm pleased they've changed the Home Secretary. I think that was unavoidable, frankly, after what went on. You know, I'm very strongly against her arguments on banning demonstrations and this sort of thing. I'm very strongly against Home Secretary telling off the head of the police in public. I don't think that's what they should do. So that was a good move. And the rest, well, we'll see. We'll see how it plays out. It's quite complicated internal reshuffle going on.
What are the Tory WhatsApp groups like this morning?
I don't know. I don't read WhatsApp. God, I mean, the idea that I look at social media. Come on, you should know me better than that.
I'm in all the Tory WhatsApp groups under an assumed name, so I keep a close eye.
Yeah, he calls himself David Davis, I should think.
There was somebody in one of them wished happy birthday to a fictitious colleague, and then lots of other people. I think it included Therese Coffey ended up congratulating.
Well, actually,
and not knowing that it was not a real person.
The Conservative Party. An actual fictitious colleague. Shows how well informed they are.
The Conservative Party has never been known as the intelligent part.
Well, there's hope for you yet, isn't it, Alex? Are you waiting by the phones that Yousaf calling you up?
Well, I mean,
thinking about the old guard.
I've been waiting for a meeting that he promised me some time ago, but that hasn't transpired yet. But look,
the meetings of the Scots government don't go well for them, as well, I remember.
The Cameron appointment. It does have one advantage that I can see. I mean, it's the case that out with the Prime Minister and perhaps the Chancellor. Nobody knows who's in the Tory cabinet. I mean, all the household names, if you call them that, in the Conservative Party have all either been sacked or resigned. So at least he's brought into the cabinet somebody who, with the sole exception of David Davis, is known to the public. You know, he is a household name, or perhaps a stately home name, in David Cameron's case. But nonetheless, there must be some advantage in that. But is this going to save the Sunak government? No chance whatsoever. Sack the governor of the Bank of England, that would help.
Oh, okay. What difference does that make?
Well, because the Conservative Party cannot win an election having, you know, put interest rates up 13 times and wrecked the finances of small businesses and mortgage holders. I mean, some things the Conservative Party can do and not do, that's one of the things you can't do.
What do you make of that, David?
Well, I have some sympathy with that. I do think interest rates are too high, and I do think we should be cutting taxes. So let's see what happens in 2 weeks' time or 1 week's time.
Do we need a new governor of the Bank of England?
Absolutely.
Well, I would have picked a different one in the first place. You know, I would have picked Andy Haldane.
Well, you could also have one with an economics degree. That would be an innovation.
Oh, come on. You're being a moderniser now.
So let's talk about your new thing before you start squabbling.
That is about the squabbling.
Exactly. It's all about squabbling. So you did it at the Edinburgh Fringe, and now it's coming to the West End. It's called The Eyes Have It, and it's you two arguing over Brexit.
Well, it was 10 different things.
Then all sorts of other subjects.
All sorts of other things.
Independence.
I mean,
for example, we did independence
in which we had an audience consisting entirely of Alexander supporters.
Well, I'm bussing them all down. I'm bussing them all down.
Ouch. No, that was a big room. Yeah.
You should try it yourself. Yeah. A large audience can be great, Mark.
I'm aware.
I'm going to bust them all down for next week's debate. But
the motion of this one is Brexit is a disaster and must be reversed.
Absolutely. You got right to the point. I mean, everybody in their ante, even David Cameron, knows that Brexit's been a disaster. Even Nigel Farage said that. But the question is, can it be reversed? So I've got on my side, I've got Lena Miller, I've got Andrew Marr, I've got all the posh, decent, intelligent people on my side. David has a gang of ruffians supporting him.
Who have you allocated me?
you've got the feisty Baroness Fox.
We got Claire Fox.
Claire Fox.
And Mike Graham, yes. Yeah. who incidentally was a tremendous hit at the Fringe, and in that people tried to hit him. But we should say this is a Tasmin Ahmed Sheikh production. It was her concept and idea. And it's actually, I don't think when we agreed to do it, I don't think either David or myself wondered how it would work. But at the Fringe, it was absolutely sensational. Yeah. I mean, you managed to debate serious subjects in a proper way, with a bit of humour laced in, and, you know, went away not trying to tear each other's eyes out afterwards.
You, Alex, obviously agree with the motion. You must half agree with it, David.
It's been
a disaster, but you want to keep plowing on.
I resigned because they weren't doing it properly, but no, it's not a disaster, and I'll go through all of that on the day, and we'll have great fun with that. But what was interesting in the Fringe was as Alex said, it was feisty, it was exciting. The reason I agreed to do it, even though, well, you've got to bear in mind in Edinburgh, talking about either independence or Brexit, you know, I'm so far behind enemy lines, I might as well have arrived by parachute. You know, I mean,
a helicopter for them to get out.
Yeah. But on the last day, I'd actually said to the audience, you know, the point of this is, you know, the last two decades, public debate has diminished. It's divided into competing echo chambers, not people not talking to each other. And Brexit's one example. All the woke stuff's another example. You know, you go through it. I mean, there's a whole load of issues. And we're having it now over civil liberties and demonstrations. And this was, trying to recreate what we did before. And we got the biggest round of applause in the entire 10 days on that. People were there to see proper debate. Good-natured. I mean, it's quite aggressive sometimes.
If either of you...
But, we weren't entirely nice to each other.
Each other's minds on anything.
Oh, God, no.
Well, but some arguments. I mean, excuse me, we definitely adjusted arguments as we went on because, obviously, one of the great things about these debates is you see what the other person's saying and you get another chance that I'll just make sure I deflect that. We should have mentioned, incidentally, that John Bercow's in the chair.
Yeah.
There's lots of fun and frivolity
we want an impartial chairman.
and for those
we don't know what he thinks about that.
Cynical, oh, yes, we saying, how on earth can we see this? It's the Leicester Square Theatre next Tuesday at 7 o'clock.
Very good. Before I let you both go, Nigel Farage has confirmed he's going into the jungle. Have either of you ever been asked to do that?
Yes.
And what did you say?
I said no. I'll find out what Nigel's being paid, and if they ask me again, who knows? if they match it.
Do you think he's going to use this as a platform to then come back as a Tory MP and take over the Tory party after the next election?
I don't think so. I think, I mean, you know...
Would you like to sit along Nigel Farage in the Commons?
I could see a benefit to it, but he's not going to come. He's not going to come in the Tory party. I mean, he wouldn't want to. I don't think. But it would be interesting. What he's trying to do is appeal to a younger audience. That's what he's seeing. He said about 75% of the people watching this are very young. You know, I hope he enjoys it. I mean, my time in the jungle, I didn't have a television camera with me.
But also, wonderful. But I was going to say there are certain aspects of that show which will be good training for being in the Tory bench. It's cohabiting with various elements of the
species.
Eating
kangaroo anuses?
Yeah, I was thinking more... I think that's excellent training for being a Conservative MP. So good luck to Nigel Farage in the jungle. We'll all enjoy these tasks that he'll have
I
to
wish
do.
Him well, and he can buy the drinks next time after that.
I think it's fair to say
it
didn't reconnect Matt Hancock with the nation, and I'm not sure this will...
Well, what could?
Lovely to see you. Never mind doing this debate. You ought to both be doing panto, I think.
The only difference is that when we're doing the debate, we do them at each other. We can rehearse some of our best lines, if you like.
Fabulous. David Davis, former Brexit Secretary and former Scottish First Minister Alex Salmond. They are taking part in The Eyes Have It at the Leicester Square Theatre next Tuesday. You can go on live, you search for that online, and you can go along to see that. Arguing about Brexit, if that's your cup of tea. And that's all we've got time for on today's episode of the podcast. If you want to get in touch, you can email me, matt@times.radio. Now you've finished listening to this, you can head over to How to Win an Election with Peter Mandelson, Daniel Finkstein and Polly McKenzie. But for now, for me, Matt Cholley, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in...
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.